Welcome to the Newington Cropsey Cultural Studies Center podcast. Newington Cropsey, exploring the arts as a source of spiritual, ethical, and cultural vitality. I'm Peter Trippi. In this podcast, James McElhenney speaks with Jack Beale. Jack Beale has played a leading role in the revival of American realist painting since the 1960s. Born in 1931 in Richmond, Virginia, he studied in Norfolk at what is now Old Dominion University, then at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and the University of Chicago. He moved to New York City in the mid-1950s and 20 years later to New York State's Delaware Valley. Committed to activism and narrative even when they are not fashionable, Beale is represented in many museum collections and has created public artworks at the Times Square subway station and the Department of Labor in Washington, D.C. In 1993, Hudson Hills Press published a monograph about Beale written by the art historian Eric Shanes. Beale is represented by George Adams Gallery in New York City.
Hi, Jack. It's a pleasure to be talking to you today.
Nice to be here.
I was wondering if we could start by speaking about how you got started, where you came from. Aren't you from Virginia originally?
I was born in Stewart Circle Hospital in Richmond, Virginia.
In Richmond, Virginia.
That's right.
And when were you aware of being in the presence of a work of art for the first time?
When I was very young, I had constant earaches, and my mother kept trying to find things to amuse me to take my mind off these earaches. And so she would get me illustrated books. And I began trying to draw from the illustrated books. Later, when we were living in a government housing project in Pennsylvania, they had brought in an art teacher, and I signed up for the course, and I did a pastel drawing that was published in either Better Homes and Gardens or Ladies' Home Journal, one of those magazines, and was my first taste of fame as an artist.
How old were you at the time?
12 or 13, maybe.
And what were the books of? Were they N.C. Wyeth or Howard Pyle?
No, they were C.W. Anderson.
C.W. Anderson.
Deep Through the Heart, Black Bay and Chestnut, Big Red. I had the whole collection of C.W. Anderson horse books.
When was the first time you were in a museum and in the presence of a painting or a sculpture?
In 1953, when I moved from Norfolk, Virginia, up to Chicago to go to school. And I enrolled in the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Every day we walked to class past masterpieces because our classrooms were in the museum. I mean, we walked past Seurat's Grand Jatte every day. It made quite an impression on me.
After your initial moment in the limelight with you know, the pastel, what was your training like prior to enrolling in the Art Institute of Chicago?
I had no training at all, except in 1952. I was working then at the Norfolk Naval Base as a spare parts consultant. Friends of mine were enrolled in the art classes at the local college. And I missed my friends, so I wanted to see my friends, so I enrolled in art classes. And I met the teacher there who, for some reason or another, thought that I had talent and encouraged me to utilize my talent. Regina Bartley Cross was her name. She encouraged me to develop my art and to go off to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And it changed my life because when I got to the Art Institute, I found this professor, Isabel Steele McKinnon Ruprecht, who was a prime pupil of Hans Hofmann. She studied with Hofmann in Germany, in Munich, in Capri, and Saint-Tropez, and caught on to his whole theory of space, and came back and taught space to us in school. Of the artists I know who studied with her, Richard Estes is probably the most profoundly affected by her. It was a totally profound experience because I never had any idea that art and science could be connected in the way that she made it seem.
How did she do that for you?
She did it by illustration, by drawing on our drawings. I mean, she would come up and take the charcoal out of your hand and draw right on your drawing and show you graphically what needed to be done. And also, I became a collector of her work. I bought from her daughter, after her death, of course, a couple of her sketchbooks. And I cherished them. And I wrote a little book about her, as a matter of fact, that was published by the Art Institute of Chicago. It was an homage to her.
So at what point did you start to develop a personal style or a direction, choosing painting as a genre and representation as a
representation direction? Actually came later. It was at the height of the abstract expressionism mm-hmm. at the time, and I, of course, like all diligent young art students at the time, was trying desperately to be another abstract expressionist painter. I became fairly good at it. I mean, I became so good that she took paintings of mine to a viewing at Martha Jackson's gallery. And Martha Jackson was so impressed with my work that she tentatively offered me a show. But I knew that this was not the kind of work that I wanted to base my life on. So I didn't have the show. I never followed that up at all.
How did you know that? What sort of informed that awareness?
I didn't feel right about the work. It just didn't sit right with me. The work seemed to come too easy. I suspected that something was wrong because I could do it so easily. So I began looking for challenges. In 1962, we left New York for the first time and moved up to the country to Black Lake in St. Lawrence County. There were four of us. Sandra was doing sculpture. The other couple, Susan Davey and Ivan Michaud, and I, all three, we tacked up homosote boards to an 8x8 foot wooden structure, stretched canvases on it, and began painting. And I started painting from nature. The first time I had actually painted from nature, and I just fell in love with it all over again. And it was astonishing because I knew that I was in the right place at last.
Well, I would imagine that at the Art Institute, they would have taught you life drawing and some observational painting as an instructional method. But what was that like, you know, to rewind a bit to your training?
I had a life drawing instructor and I had a painting instructor. I studied with Boris Annisfeld, who had been a ballet designer for the Ballet Russe of Monte Carlo. Boris had an international reputation, but I was caught up in abstraction at the time. So I was looking at a still life and making an abstraction out of it. I had almost no academic training at all. My academy was the Isabel Steele McKinnon Academy, and it was more than what I needed because it was what I needed to understand the business of making pictures.
So what was the result of this first expedition into the woods to paint from nature? And I mean, I'm trying to imagine it's an 8x8 foot panel with homosote attached, stretching canvas onto it, and that's your easel.
That's right.
Amazing.
I would go out every day and paint all day. And I had stretched one big canvas down by the river because we lived right on the river. And I was painting the island across from us and the river itself. The guy who ran the floodgates up at Hewelton let the floodgates loose, and the water came up, and I had to stand in water up to my thighs to finish the painting. I had a family of catfish living under my canvas, and they were swimming around there while I was painting away, and it was a grand and glorious time. Every afternoon, we'd go fishing. Ivan and I would take his Kalamazoo canoe, and we'd go up creek and fish. And we had remarkable fishing, and it was an Edenic situation for us both.
So tell me, Jack, at what point did you start working with a figure?
Several years after that, and at first, rather tentatively. I've just been going through all my slides, trying to assemble a catalog resume, and I'm looking at those primitive figures that I painted, and they're very coarse and very rough. but they led to something further along than that. And I eventually got rather sophisticated at painting the figure.
Who were you looking at that time? Who on the scene, were you aware of the Bay Area painters? Or
no, the two most profound influences on my work at the time were Pierre Bonnard and Georges Braque. And neither of them were great academic painters of the human figure. But they both influenced me so strongly that it sticks with me to this day. And I loved the work of Edward Hopper. As a matter of fact, in those days, Lloyd Goodrich had just come out with his immense Hopper book. Mm-hmm. And I had a show, and Lloyd and Dora Goodrich came to my show and praised me for my work. And I just about fell over in a faint because it was high praise from someone who admired someone as much as he admired Edward Hopper.
Where were you exhibiting?
At Alan Frumkin Gallery.
At Alan Frumkin.
Yes. My wife, Sandra, was showing in the Museum of Modern Art when she was 22 years old. I did not have a show until I was 34 years old.
How were you earning a living?
I was working as a shop teacher at a place called the Church of All Nations, over on Lower Second Avenue, and Sandra was working as a shop teacher at Downtown Community School. She probably the only female wood shop teacher in the history of the country, but still. And I also worked for Audits and Surveys, a questionnaire type. I worked as a coder for them, and we got along. We worked part-time and sometimes full-time, but mostly part-time and temporary, and we got along.
And when did you start exhibiting your work?
I had my first show. My first one-man show in New York was in 1965. I sold every painting at my first show. It was astonishing.
How did you and Alan Frumkin find each other?
Actually, Dennis Adrian was running the Frumkin Gallery in New York in those days. Dennis and I had become friends, and Dennis was taking paintings of mine and selling them to his friends. Then he introduced my work to Alan. He tried to get Alan interested in the work. Alan became interested enough so that in 1964, he gave me a show in Chicago. I had a two-person show with Ray Reshoft and me. And in the summer of 64, we were living down in Wyalusing, Pennsylvania. I made the first important painting of my life. I made a painting called The Saw. It's about a big circular saw that was out in the backyard of this farmhouse we were living in. And I came back to New York that fall and showed Alan that painting, and he said, "Beale, if you can make four or five more paintings as strong as this, I'll give you a show." And that was on Labor Day of 64, and on January 25th of 1965, I had my first one-man show.
I'm James McElhenney, speaking today with representational painter Jack Beale. Well, I know Frumkin came from Chicago originally. Did you have any connection with him in Chicago?
In Chicago, I was a member of the group who called ourselves the Art Students League, and we also had a fraternity. At any rate, I submitted a work for membership in the Art Students League, and Alan Frumkin had been the juror. And I made up a thing looking like a pseudo Jean Miro sculpture out of chicken bones and rocks and tied together with string. And Frumkin, I'm told, took one look at it and said, "Jesus Christ, if I see another one of these things, I'll puke." And that was his first reaction to my work.
And you didn't remind him of it when you encountered him again?
No, I did remind him of it, as a matter of fact. And once, years later, when we were first up here and we were living out in the barn because we were building the house, He came and they were staying in a motel because they wanted to visit with us. So we went down to the motel and had this intense argument about Cézanne. I said that the whole idea of modern art is based on a misunderstanding of Cézanne's use of brushstrokes. I said, I'd love to do a painting called Cézanne Without the Brushstrokes. And he said, well, why don't you do it? So I went back, and we were living in the grain room of the barn. And I sat up there that night, and I made a painting called Cézanne Without the Brushstrokes, and I gave that painting to Alan. I gave him that, and I gave him another painting called The Madison Nude. And it turns out that they're the only two paintings that any of his artists ever gave him. And my relationship with Alan was always sort of tense. It's that he didn't want to be friends. He didn't want it to be on a friendly basis.
It was a purely
he wanted
collegial,
it to be
professional business.
Yeah. That's right. But it was painful to me because I wanted to be friends, but I realized I couldn't. So I made up for it by to give him those paintings.
So was he the same towards his other artists, like McGarrell and Barnes and Pearlstein?
I think he was.
Yeah.
And because eventually, I mean, the most shocking thing that ever happened was after he had coddled along Philip Pearlstein for years, backed him up financially and on the purchase of the buildings that he bought and stuff like that, Philip left the gallery. It was just shocking. And the Frumkins came here that summer and were just both of them in tears. I mean, it was stunning. So I don't know. Alan is a very complex man. And he was in the hospital, you know, deathly ill. And I went to visit him and I took him a couple of books. And it cheered him up a great deal that I took the time to come see him. And that's as close to being friends as we ever got. And I feel bad about that. I feel that I could have made more attempt. They used to come here and stay with us, but it was always tense between us. I don't know why that was.
So, Jack, let's take a step back to Chicago.
Yeah.
And sort of do a mini biography moving from Chicago, from Illinois to New York.
I want to start off by saying that Sandra and I have always been pioneers. And when we were in school in Chicago, I had been in school for 2 years. Sandra had been there only 1 year. I said, let's leave. Let's go to New York and become famous artists. And Sandra said, no, I had learned so much in my first year. I want to stick around for another year. So we stuck around for another year, and she didn't learn nearly as much. And by the end of her second year, my third year, we took off and left. We moved to New York City. We moved into a loft behind the High Sam Stove Company on Stanton Street. We were paying $35 a month for that loft. We lived there for a while, and then we had to move down to Virginia for a while to take care of my mother. And then we came back, and we got a place on Bleecker Street, in a building that it had, up until we moved in there, had not been a residence. And we took the top floor of the three-story building.
And what year would this have been?
In 1957. There were few artists living around in lofts in those days, but very few. And we got tied up with the Artist Tenants Association. And they asked us if we were willing to become the test case in the city versus the artist litigation. And so we said, yeah. So we were chosen to be among the first artists to have AIR signs over our door. We likened it to being the blood of the lamb over the door that the Jews had to have it. But every couple of days, there would be inspectors coming in. Building inspectors, fire inspectors, police would come in. The police would come in at 4 o'clock in the morning, shine flashlights on our face to make sure that we were living there. they chose us because Sandra and I had no children. We were both professional artists, and we were both on the verge of making ourselves into important people. So we got that done, and we moved from there to 101 Prince Street, right next door to where the Apple store is now located.
Mm-hmm.
We took over the sixth floor of this building, in which Ray Parker was our downstairs neighbor, but he wasn't living there. He just used it as a studio. Leslie and Chuck Close had the seventh floor of our building. We had the sixth floor. And we left New York, and we moved upstate to the country. We had to give up our loft and moved up here and bought a building that had been a sawmill on the banks of the Aulard Creek.
Well, Jack, I'd like to talk about your work a little bit.
Okay.
I have this image of the 8-foot square homosote easel nailed to a tree and imagining these giant, very painterly, probably landscapes
at
the time. And gradually you were moving towards some of the work for which you're well known, which involves the figure.
Yep.
And often in interiors. And how did that evolution unfold?
As I was working, as my act got cleaner, as my line became more precise, I began to feel that I wanted to make art in which there was no difference between the art and the real world. I wanted art to be like life and life to be like art. I began having fantasies when I was working on my paintings that I could, if I was painting someone precisely, I could have conversations with the person in the painting, that I could write imaginary letters to them and they could write imaginary notes back to me. I began to believe in it so firmly that at times I would have dreams about the people in the paintings. I had a very beautiful wife, and she was working as a sculptor. We had different lifestyles in those days. She was a morning person. She would get up in the morning and go right to her sculpture and work all day. And by the evening time, she would be tired and willing to lie down for a while. I'd put a television set in front of her and turn it on, and she'd lie there and pose for me. And I tried to ennoble her, to show my love of her in my paintings, not at the time realizing how prurient they appeared to some other people. As a matter of fact, that happened one day. I had a painting going to a show, and the truck came before I expected it to come, and I didn't have time to cover the painting with brown paper. So I took it down to the sidewalk and carried it from the doorway to the truck, and two Hispanic day laborers came by and just started touching and kissing the painting. And it shocked me so much, but at the same time that it horrified me, it also thrilled me.
It's what you were looking for. I mean, art and life.
Of course I was, but I didn't realize at the time that it would be so intense, such an intense reaction. And there it was. I've never studied anatomy. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I've studied some on my own, but I've never had taken a class in anatomy, although a couple of times in our summer sessions, we had anatomy teachers, and I would sit in on them for a while. But I've always painted what I see.
Mm.
And I mean, that's primarily my studies of anatomy have been based on direct physical observation. And I've just tried to get the life in the person as close as I can by what I can see of the person.
As your own work evolved and began to develop from abstract expressionism to working from nature out in the landscape to working from Sandra in the evening,
yep.
How did your heroes change? Did you start having a look at artists like Courbet or, I mean, who did you admire as your work began to change?
I am in love with great art.
All of it?
All of it. Courbet, Caravaggio, Titian, Tintoretto, Corot, Degas. these guys are my profound inspiration. I mean, these are the people that make me realize that I'm doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the kind of work I'm doing now is so out of step with what the art world sees as art. But I know that working in the way that those guys worked was forever. And I'm hoping that my work is also forever.
I remember as an art student encountering your work in a book called The New Realism and exhibitions at Frumkin. And I know that a lot of younger artists at that time were sort of shocked and inspired to see people who were going, as some said, back to the figure, as Porter said. He said, well, people were always working from, you know, the figure.
Yes.
And just because the critics are choosing now to pay attention to them again doesn't mean anything's new. But your evolution from sort of an Abex-inspired student, Art Institute of Chicago, moving to New York to establish your name, coming up here, finding this connection with nature, and then later, you know, the human figure, you started out working within the mainstream and then you moved away from it.
Yes. But I figure that I'm working in the great mainstream.
I see.
All this the stuff that is going on nowadays is like fluff. It cannot abide. It cannot endure. Because, I mean, what's in the museums is permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And this other stuff is temporary.
So are you a rebel?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a rebel. I mean, I always have been.
Well, you're a Virginian, so you got to be part rebel.
That's right. Absolutely. But Sandra and I were coordinators of the first peace march, first anti-Vietnam peace march that originated in Philadelphia and New Haven, Connecticut. We were in the offices of the War Resisters League down on Nassau Street, looking down on City Hall Park in New York, when there were 11 marchers who had marched from Philadelphia to New York.
And what year was that?
It was in the late 50s, early 60s.
So who organized the contingent in New Haven? Who organized the contingent in Philly?
One of the leaders of the group was Dave Dellinger.
Okay.
We used to let people stay in our loft, and one morning I woke up and there were two bodies on the floor wrapped up in sleeping bags. And I walked over and looked, and one of them was our old friend Al Urey, and the other was someone I didn't recognize. And he rolled over and looked up at me and said, "Hi, I'm Dave Dellinger." And we were friends with Ralph DeGia and David McReynolds and all those people. We saw the anti-Vietnam peace march grow from 11 people to half a million. It was phenomenal.
How did that affect your work?
I tried to make a painting about it. I made an 18-foot-long painting of Sandra on a sofa in our barn up at Black Lake with psychedelic windrows of hay on the field behind. I had the feeling that if I made the painting good enough, that the Vietnam War would end. And I didn't make the painting good enough, and the Vietnam War did not end. And it sort of broke my heart, because I wondered at that point if any painting could be good enough to make the war end. And I figured probably not.
So the painting had almost an ex voto animistic desire.
The painting was called Peace, and the painting was shown in the Whitney Museum in the 22 Realist show. It was a show in which I had my two nudes on the roof, which is an 8-by-10-foot painting. It was hung in the lobby of the Whitney Museum, and then upstairs I had the Peace painting. And a bizarre story about that is Jim Monty was the curator of the show, and he published a catalog, and in the catalog, there's a paragraph or a section about 21 of the 22 artists in the show. Not a word about me.
Why was that, do you think?
I confronted him about it, and I said, asked him why, and he said, you can't be right. You can't be right. He said, and he gets the thing out and looks at it, and I was right. And I think it was because the piece painting was so far away from traditional realism, from what was seen as realism. I think that it threw him for a loop.
But how do you define realism?
I don't know.
Because if you imagine somebody like Tom Benton or Paul Cadmus or Raphael Moses Sawyer or
yes.
John Coke or whoever,
yes.
you know, Edward Hopper.
Yes.
Representational painting. I mean, realism, is it only a word or is it an idea?
I think it was because the message I was trying to impart overpowered my ability to be able to paint it.
Thank you, because I wanted to talk to you about narrative painting.
There you go.
Because your work was, I think, for many people, one of the first bodies of work. You were one of the first artists to actually come out and say, we're telling stories with these pictures. We're
yes.
trying to do things other than just simply make abstract paintings out of objects and bodies and trees and hills. And it's not just a formal exercise in making a picture. It's also making a picture that tells a story, that does something more.
It's, again, the idea of making art like life, making life like art. And there becomes a need in the artist to tell stories. And I think that all of us have that need, but some of us have it stronger than others. Philip Perlstein, I think, is teetering on the brink of wanting to tell us a story, but he doesn't. His stories are all contained in inner stories. And Alfred Leslie
mm-hmm.
wants to tell world stories. Alfred is one painter whose work I admire greatly because he wants to make direct contact with his viewer.
Well, the painting of the death of O'Hara on the beach is like
yeah.
a modern history painting.
Yes,
it's like
it
the
is.
Death of Wolfe by West.
Yes.
Sort of a contemporary history painting.
Yes. But it was a painting in which he was involved, so it's a little bit different from Wolfe and West because it's Alfred was there. I mean, Alfred was almost had blood on his hands in a situation like that. And there are times when something happens that is so amazing that you have to make a picture of it. When I decided to do The Virtues and Vices, mm-hmm. I wanted to do them in everyday terms, in terms that anyone could understand, because they were normal situations,
mm-hmm.
actual situations that existed. So I made the Prudence, Avarice, Lust, Justice, and Anger painting, made it looking like a stage set, but it was a stage set in reality.
You weren't casting the characters in togas or ancient costumes.
No.
Or they're wearing flannel shirts and
blue jeans.
And jeans, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they're sort of everyday
yeah.
people. But there were other artists at the same time who were sort of working with the idea of storytelling and narrative, like Tillum, Paul Georges, and others.
Milay Andreevich.
Andreevich.
Yes.
How do you see yourself in relationship to that dialogue?
I think all of us were trying to expand the concept of what realism could be. It was about that time that the America 76 show came mm-hmm. on, the bicentennial exhibition. A bunch of us were hired by the U.S. Department of the Interior to make art for the show. And we all got on the train and went down to Washington, D.C. for the opening. And I'm on the train, and we're all sitting around talking. We're talking real estate and made problems and stuff like that. And then finally, I stood up and said, you guys, we've got to stand up for realism. I mean, we have to take what we're doing seriously. I said, we can't any longer just think of ourselves as making images. We have to know that we're making messages as well. The forces of modernism are against us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's painful that art should be riven like this in two parts, realism and non-realism. But it's the reality of the situation is that, and we have to fight that. And I got almost no response from the others at all. Nothing happened out of that, except later I would get messages from people saying, yeah, they agreed with me, but then they didn't do anything about it.
Afraid to rock the boat?
I don't know. I've never been able to figure it out.
Well, it seems like a lot of the realism, a lot of the work that was being called realism was in fact formalism with images. Basically, it was abstract painting made up of imagery, and that whatever the content of the object might imply, however it might be understood by, let's say, a lay person unschooled in the critical issues of art at that moment, might read the picture entirely in a different way from a person who was an artist or a critic or a student and who was expected to understand it as a formal construct.
Well, one of the problems there is that there are a number of realists who are so Apollonian in their nature, in their makeup, that their work tend to be more formal than human.
Mm-hmm.
The artists whom I admire are the more Dionysian types, the ones who take chances, who draw things on a diagonal, who make things slant, go off at angles.
Well, I think everybody has some kind of a struggle within themselves about which impulse they want to follow, like what's the correct path.
I've drawn up a chart, as a matter of fact.
Tell us about it.
That you can judge yourself. It has five columns. On one side is Poussin, on the other side is Caravaggio. Poussin being Apollo and Caravaggio being Dionysus.
Mm-hmm.
And in Poussin, you have the formalism up and horizontals and verticals. In Caravaggio, you have diagonals. And I say that the diagonals are the things that make life happen in a painting.
And sweeping arabesques.
Yes.
And logarithmic curves.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
The other thing I'd like to ask you is whether you identify more with a northern painting tradition, a northern European, or sort of the Latin tradition of Italian painting. I mean, having a look at your work, it seems like it's tied a bit to some of the German painters of the 19th century, people like Lovis Corinth, perhaps, or
I like all these guys.
Yeah.
I am drawn to Italian art primarily.
The Venetians, let's say.
Except for Caravaggio, all the rest are Venetians. But I also love some Germanic art, but only the more dynamic sort of Germanic art. I mean, I admire Lucas Cranach,
mm-hmm.
but I could never paint like Lucas Cranach because he's too Apollonian for me. He's too horizontal and vertical. I love British painting.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the people that I shouldn't probably love, it's British painting, which is my bloodline heritage, you know? I mean, I'm Welsh and English is my background. I just love art. I have such a collection of books that I look at all the time. But it runs the gamut. It runs from Pierre Bonnard to Georges Braque, to people who couldn't be further apart and yet who are inseparable in my mind.
Another range of issues I'd like to explore is the whole idea of the content of the narrative, not just telling a story, but telling a story that has some value, that has a particular value or reflects a set of values. I think about the late writer John Gardner. You're smiling. I know you know what I'm talking about.
I love him. I wrote letters to him.
The ideas he espoused at the end of his life about a morality of art having some kind of a moral compass and
yes.
a purpose beyond aesthetics.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
In my more optimistic, positive, upbeat part of my mind, I want to believe that art can heal people, can make the world better. And yet there are days when I just don't feel like it's going to happen at all. But is what keeps me going, after all, is it that we can set an example for other people to live by. And we do it with our lives, we do it with our art, we do it with our friends. And we try to make our art like our life like our art.
We're talking to Jack Beal, radical, reverent, rabble-rousing realist painter. Why have you stopped painting the nude?
In 1973, we had gone to Europe, first time in our lives. We were there for 3 months. We came back, and I had a show, a mini retrospective, that showed at the Boston University, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts in Richmond, and at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. The night of the Chicago opening, Alan Frumkin said, Jack, Art Paul, who's the art director for Playboy magazine, lives across the street here, and he's having a party in your honor. And I said, Alan, I don't care about Playboy magazine one bit. He said, Jack, you have to go. You have to go have a drink with the fella, thank him very much, and leave. I said, okay. So I went, and I had a drink with the fella, and I thanked him very much, and I left. The next morning, his secretary called and asked permission for Playboy magazine to come in and photograph nude bunnies in front of my paintings. Not bunny rabbits, nude Playboy bunnies.
I understood what you meant.
I decided I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have anybody be able to use my paintings for that sort of propaganda ever again. And I come to realize it. Most of my paintings ended up in people's bedrooms. A lesbian woman who lives on 57th Street has one of the sexiest paintings I ever made of my wife hanging on her bedroom wall, where she and her girlfriend get to look at it all the time.
It inspires their amorous mischief.
It must. It must.
Well, that's not a bad thing, is it?
It got to feel like a bad thing.
I'm sorry.
Yes. So that's why I quit. And I've not done a nude since then.
I know a lot of artists, even a lot of abstract painters like Diebenkorn, who's really abstract, but or Olitsky, continued to hire a model every week just to draw as a kind of
yes.
point of rigor. Have you abandoned that, or do you do that still?
I do that. I do it, but I'm not so much anymore, because getting a model up here is not so easy. But when we were teaching classes, we were teaching regularly up until I had my stroke in 1998. We were teaching regularly out there. And we would hire models and bring them in. And occasionally we would have group sessions where we would hire a model and just all sit around and draw. But I haven't had the need to do that recently. I don't know why not, but it happens.
We've influenced a lot of young artists. There are a number of artists I know of. You spoke of Walter Hatke,
yes,
up in Schenectady.
Yes.
I think about Dana Van Horn. I think about Dean Hartung and many others who've worked with you as either studio assistants, students.
Yes.
How did you organize that kind of environment? Was it just you had this space and venue here and it was a possibility? How did they find you?
Sandra and I have always been wide open to maybe me more than her, but she's more of a hermit than I am. But we always seem to attract people and make people comfortable in our place and willing to come back again. And when we did the labor murals, as a matter of fact, there were four of us who worked on those paintings. We lived in this house for 2.5 years together. Every fourth night, it would be each one's turn to make a gourmet dinner for the other three of us. We lived here. We painted all day. On Sunday morning, sometimes we would take a break and go into town, get the Sunday papers, and have pancakes. Other than that, we were out in that studio working. We didn't have a single argument. We didn't even have a cross word between us. It was phenomenal. It was peace on the earth. I had two abstract painters, hard edge painters. So they got to paint all the hard edges in the paintings. Dana is a realist, and he got to paint all the landscapes. And I was the boss, so I painted the figures. And Sandra, God love her, got to paint the ducks. And when Hilton Kramer reviewed the paintings, he liked the ducks best of all. Sandra has never let me forget.
It almost sounds like Rubens with Franz Schneiders and Flower Bruegel and his whole posse of painters there.
It was. It was like that.
Is it still continuing? Are you working now on any large projects?
No. As a matter of fact, since I had my stroke, I can't control my hand the way I want to. My fine line, my edges have gone on me. So I've been painting relatively little because I get up there and I start the painting and I start getting so frustrated because I can't do it the way I want to do it. So I'm working on a double self-portrait, and it's painful because it doesn't come easily the way it should. So I'm trying to paint looser, as is something I was hoping to get to painting looser. But I wanted to do it on my own terms and not on the terms that it's happening to me.
Seems like a lot of late career artists look at Titian, for example.
Yes.
The work just opens up. It becomes very gestural.
Yes.
And very lively.
Yes.
And yet it still has the rigor of composition and structure. Or Lovis Corinth, who would be an analogy, an artist who was very deft and skilled at the height of his career, has a stroke, and evolves this whole new style, which at the end was lively and vibrant, and he's kind of inspirational.
I'm trying. I'm fighting my way back from that, you know. But what happened was I had this major leg operation where I had the arteries in my legs removed and replaced with veins. And the third day after the operation, I had a stroke. And I didn't realize at the time, but when I got back to painting again, it had changed me so much. And getting old is hell, but it's better than
the alternative. Not for sissies, to quote the late Betty Davis.
Right? That's right.
What are your hopes now for the future of painting? How do you think the digital age has changed painting?
I think there will forever be people who want to make realist paintings. I think that there are all sorts of other possibilities for making art. And most of them have nothing to do with art, but seem to have something to do with art. Most of what I see in the art world nowadays is not what I think of as art at all. So I just have to abide it as though it's a disease that we're all going through and we're going to get past it sooner or later. But I think that there will always be an impulse to celebrate the lines and forms of the human body, because it's what we are. It's what all our concepts of beauty are based on, those movements. Try as we might, we can't get away from that. That's the reality of our existence. So we have to celebrate that.
And all design begins with nature.
That's right.
And we are part of it.
And we're going to keep on celebrating ourselves, because otherwise we'll destroy ourselves.
So tell me, Jack, you stated earlier that you were active in the formation of the Artist's Choice Museum, organizing exhibitions there. Share with us a little bit of how that came about. What drew you to that task?
We're at an after-opening party at Alan Frumkin's apartment, and Paul Georges is there. And he starts talking about making a museum. And I said, it sounds like a terrific idea. And he starts building it up. And like a damn fool, I said to him, Paul, I'll follow you anywhere. So he gets me on the board, and I become his antithesis. We fight our way right through to the establishment of the situation. I put together the show. I got Francis and Sidney Lewis to agree to buy something from the show, and they bought my painting. My painting, which is, it's called Fortitude, and it's a portrait of Phyllis and Don Scriver, and it's in the collection of the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And they bought that painting, and that financed the whole show. It financed the setting up of the museum and everything. Neither the Lewises nor I was ever given any verbal credit for doing this. And it was the sort of thing that I think you can't get away with. I mean, you have to acknowledge the people who are doing things for you, and they weren't. But anyway, the museum was established, and it got going, and they had a couple of shows.
The West Broadway.
Yes.
Right.
And then they collapsed, and that was the end of it. And I heard that Paul was sitting with his family in France, having had lunch, and he lifts his glass of wine and says, "Ah, what a remarkably beautiful day this is," and sets his glass down and collapses and dies right on the spot. And everybody thought he was faking it out at first. They couldn't believe that he had died like that. It's a tragic end to an important life.
Well, he made that one painting, The Rape of the Muse, that caused all of that commotion.
That's right.
And his feuds with other artists.
Yes. One of the worst paintings ever made, but one of the most ambitious paintings ever made.
Well, I think a lot of us of a particular age recall Friday evenings at the Figurative Alliance at the Jewish Y on East Broadway.
Absolutely.
And there's the gladiatorial contests between people like Paul George's Lauterman, Bell.
Yes.
Do you think we're in a passionless age? It seems to me that back in the 70s, people would argue furiously about issues of art. Now everybody's interested in money.
Sandra and some local people here have decided that they want to reinstitute an artist club. But an artist club...
For arguing and drinking, right?
Yeah, but up here in the boondocks, it doesn't seem to me it can have the kind of vitality that the club had in New York.
To tell us a little about where you are now in this area of the Western Catskills, there are a lot of artists around here, are there not?
There are probably too many artists.
How could there be too many artists?
Because most of them are pretty piss poor artists.
Oh, dear. So who's in your orbit up here now? Are there any...
Any terrific artists.
Any terrific
artists? There's Beth Furman. But also there's a woman who lives over in Bovina named Sandy Finkenberg, who is a sensational artist. She paints an egg tempera, and it takes her a long time to make each painting. There's a woman here in Oneonta, Karen Elting, who is a very strongly social person, who is a very talented artist, but she doesn't have time to make her art because she's so bound up in Planned Parenthood and boards, committees, and stuff like that. She doesn't have the time.
Well, you seem to be able to have created a dynamic, active career as a painter while being a social activist. How did you do it?
Because that's all I do. I do painting and I do social activism, and that's all. And I don't do much social activism anymore, but albeit a few years back, we had a guy who was about to put in an 88-unit trailer park a mile and a half up the creek here, and right on the creek. It would have been polluted the creek forever. And I went to bat, and I prevented him from doing so. I made books, computer-generated books. I did research. I made photographs of trailer parks and superimposed them on the land up there. I went to the town board of the town of Meredith. I went to the town board of the town of Franklin. I told the town of Franklin that if the creek got polluted, that their town swimming pool would be polluted. I got him stopped, and he ended up building one house on that land. I've always tried to live the fullest life I possibly could.
What advice would you give to a young artist listening to this interview?
Get involved. do things. Make sure that every aspect of your life works for the good of the world, for the good of yourself, of your friends, of your neighborhood, of your community, and of the world itself. Try to make decisions in which there are no negatives. Try to eliminate the idea of negatives as much as you can. We sort our throwaways. We do everything we can to keep the land as clean as possible. And our next-door neighbors who live on land that used to be part of this property are turning their property into a junk hole. And I want to say something to them about it, but I know that that's their way of life and this is ours.
At least they're downstream.
They are downstream. Thank God for small favors.
A lot of artists I know who have homes in this area stretching down into the endless mountains in Pennsylvania have gotten very active in trying to prevent the gas mining of the Marcellus Shale via fracking.
Yes.
And I imagine that you're involved in this as well.
Yes. And I keep reading about people who are so bound up in money that they want fracking to happen. They think that us anti-frackers are radical people who want things to stay the same. We don't want things to stay the same. We just don't want things to be polluted.
Well, Jack, what's interesting is in the course of this whole conversation, we haven't really talked about style in any kind of rancorous way. When you talk about realism, it's always been as a positive thing, as a way to connect art to life and life to art. I have a memory, as I expect you do, of the days when the realist revival was underway in the early 70s, late 60s, where there was a lot of rancor between, you know, the exponents of abstraction or the exponents of representation. And that's been totally absent from this conversation, which I find to be a positive thing.
Yes.
How do you view that in hindsight now?
I used to be the realist painter who was friends with abstractionists. I had a big color TV set, and on Sunday afternoons, we would watch the NFL games. And Red Grooms would come over, and I have two etchings that Red did of me watching NFL games. Bob Ryman would come over, and two Christmases in a row, I dressed up as Santa Claus for his kids for Christmas. Tom Doyle is a good, dear friend of ours.
I know Tom.
Yeah, Tom lives out in Connecticut, and I did a portrait of Tom and Jane.
Mm-hmm.
I was their buddies, but there came a point when I had to make a separation. I was so firmly strong for realism that I had to break myself off from those guys. And I'm afraid I might have made some enemies in the process. But, I mean, in those days, I was kind of lost in my work. I kept trying to figure my work out. My work would vacillate between expressionism and hard-edge abstraction. And I made a series of paintings about a table. The next thing I knew, I had made 17 paintings of the table from every possible point of view. And I had a show of those table paintings in Chicago. I didn't sell a thing, or I don't think I sold a thing. Those paintings were important to me at the time because they said something to me about pictorial space and what was going on in a painting. And in a way, they were a little bit connected with what the sculptors of the group called the Park Place Group were trying to do at the time. And I made a big homage to contemporary American sculpture. Was 12 drawings of various details of 12 different, I think it was 12 different sculptors, charcoal drawings that fit together like one giant exquisite corpse.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to understand the relationship between the third dimension and the second dimension and trying to bust through the flatness of the paper, of the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And I got there finally. I got as far as I wanted to get with it, and I made some deliberate breakthroughs. I mean, I made for myself ideas that came off the canvas, reached out into the world. I didn't actually make forms that reached out into the world, but forms that seemed to reach out into the world. And my wife, Sandra, went even farther than I did, but she, again, confined herself to the paper, but busted through that picture plane like nobody's business. And it was something that totally involved us for a while. And we both went through that almost like some kind of disease we had caught on to. And we broke free and healed ourselves.
So that was the first step away from this struggle between expressionism and hard-edge abstraction.
No, that was after. That was after that. It was the beginning of moving towards realism work. Yes,
and
you're right.
Through that, moving towards content, moving towards narrative.
Yes, yes.
So what do you hope will be your lasting legacy as an artist?
That someone will say, well, he was a ragged old cuss, wasn't he? That's about it.
We've been speaking with Jack Beal today at his lovely home on the western slope of the Catskills, which he shares with his wife, artist Sandra Freckleton. Thank you, Jack. A terrific conversation.
Thank you very much.
This podcast with Jack Beal and James McElhenney has been brought to you by the Newington Cropsey Cultural Studies Center. For more information about the center or about our guest, Jack Beal, please visit our website at www.nccsc.net. Podcast audio production by Paul Ruest for Argo Studios in New York. I'm Peter Trippi. Thanks for listening.